So welcome to the next episode of the CAM Marketing Save the Planet podcast. And today, Gemma and I are thrilled to be joined by Chris Baker, strategist turned entrepreneur, who is now the CEO over at Serious Tissues. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks very much. Thanks for having me on.
So it's great to have you here. So let's start off with an introduction to yourself and Serious Tissues and how your world has moved into what you were doing before through this entrepreneurship piece through into Serious Tissues. So a little bit of a backstory, please.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm really drawn to the title of the podcast. I think it's probably something I've been leaning into and a question I've been trying to answer for the last 20 years, really. I think I spent a long time working in ad agencies as a strategist. Most recently, I was head of strategy and social change at FCB Inferno and spent a lot of time gradually building a bit of a specialty around social change, around working a lot with different government departments around things like knife crime, worked on obesity and things like that in Australia, and then came back and spent a lot of time on different charities, so the likes of NSPCC, UNICEF, Barnardo's. We launched a big campaign with Pearson called Project Literacy, which is all about helping big companies have an impact on literacy at a global scale. And all of these things, gradually, I think it became a bit of a passion point and a bit of an area of expertise. And I wanted to do more with the skills I'd learned to bring about positive change in the world rather than just sell more things. Or, you know, that's maybe a little bit dismissive, but you know, yeah, the balance of the two, I think using those commercial skills for good was very much the focus. While I was still at FCB, we worked together with the guys at Big Issue to launch a business called Change Please, which is a coffee business, a social enterprise that trains people who are formerly homeless as baristas, gives them the chance to get back on their feet. And it's gone amazingly well over the, I think it's coming up to 9 years now. It's been running. It's in 8 countries. It's grown and grown and grown. And, huge amounts of corporates buy it for their offices. It's in the likes of WeWork and David Lloyd Gyms and Virgin Atlantic and making big inroads in the US with the likes of Google as well. So really fabulous. Incredible. And I think, yeah, I think what that taught us really was this thought that if you can change how people spend their money, you can change the world. So a really small change from you walking into your Costa or your Starbucks to buying your coffee from Change Please would help give another guy a new shot at life. And then similarly with big corporates, you know, the difference you can make by moving the coffee spend with WeWork to a company that's like Change Please that's helping is huge. So really it's a case of this thought of move the money, change the world is probably the mantra I've gravitated towards since then.
Fantastic. And is that an initiative you're still involved with?
Yeah, so not as much as I was. So Jamal Ezel, who founded it and is CEO, has run it and is an absolute force of nature and has driven it from day one. I was still involved in it while I was still at the agency, and then I left FCB in 2019, and with the view of getting more involved in that and pushing into new ventures that do similar, which is when Serious Tissues was born. Yeah. So Serious Tissues, working with Jamal, working with Rich and Martin, actually, who was a creative director at FCB Inferno at the same time. We, between the four of us, we've got 8 kids. I think at the time they were all eight and younger. So it was sort of slightly crazy and we were all tired and stressed, but also, you know, having a pretty firm eye on the future, reading a lot about climate change, thinking that the world's going to be a very different place in 20 years than it is now. So trying to do something that would make a positive impact on climate change and deforestation. So we had the idea of, I suppose, taking what we'd learned with Change Please and looking at something that was a case of looking at getting people to make a simple switch to make a positive impact. Serious Tissues, on the D2C side, the consumer side, for a long time has been planting one tree per role. So since launch, we've planted over 1 million trees now across the world in 8 different countries and in the UK. We're also plastic free. carbon neutral, UK made. And that's really, you know, that's grown a lot over the last few years. We probably the biggest thing that's happened was actually when you and I met, Michelle, with with Serious Tissues winning the Sky Zero Footprint Fund at the back end of 2022, winning £1 million worth of advertising to be able to get the message out there. And that was a huge moment in our story so far.
Amazing. And sounds like, you know, you've taken on a lot throughout your career. It sounds like there's a lot of social marketing involved there, you know, around so obesity, helping people through the, you know, switching over to a better, I guess, spend with your coffee, moving, taking the money and sharing that money and influencing where people buy and good coming from that. And that's something that we touch on and talk about around social marketing and the fact that it plays a really important role, doesn't it, in the kind of sustainable marketing skill sets that are required now, because it's usually associated with kind of healthcare and you know, drink drive campaigns and wear a seatbelt and things like that. But it's moving more into now, I guess, the more mainstream of when you ask marketers, you know, how do you move away from your typical growth and revenue and profit and how do you get click-throughs and likes and engagement into social marketing becoming more of a primary skill set that's coming back, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I particularly gravitated towards behavioral science and all of the different parts of the toolkit from that. And I think it was really interesting. There's a bit of a light bulb moment when you look at all these big companies, you know, the likes of, if you're from your Facebooks to your Googles, everyone is building their experiences with behavioral science in mind. So, you know, Zuckerberg talks a lot about the dopamine hits you get on Facebook all the time, those little notifications popping up. Everything has been built with behavioral science in mind to get you to spend more money or spend more time on a website or whatever that commercial end is. And using those tools for good feels like the right thing to do. It's an incredibly powerful toolkit. Using those tools for commercial good, but also social good, I think. And I think the thing that point around changing how people spend their money to change the world, I think, you know, behavior change is really hard.
Yeah.
Long-term, getting behavior change to stick and getting people to, whether it's giving up smoking or driving differently or eating differently, it's really fucking hard to get people to switch properly.
Yeah.
But they're always going to buy toilet roll, tampons, coffee, drive a different car. They're always going to do these things. So if you're getting someone to literally pick up your product rather than a different one, it is the smallest behavior change you can get someone to make. Mm. They're already doing it. As obviously there's, you know, questions around cost and availability that you'll hopefully get over. But that's I suppose from, you know, spending 20 years kind of working to this point, get someone to switch from this to this is the sort of North Star I'm working towards. And I think that, you know, that's worked amazingly well with Change Please. It's working with Serious Tissues. You're seeing it with brands like Liquid Death in the States that have positioned themselves as a more sustainable, but also, you know, an incredible brand. It's just a simple switch that can make a big positive impact on the world. And that's probably the thing I've gravitated towards so much over particularly the last 3 or 4 years.
And was that the formation of Serious? Was it a case of let's look at where we can make those simple switches? So let's look at the things people do naturally, organic. They've been doing it for years, you know, loo roll, tissues. And let's disrupt that market with something that is an alternative, because there weren't that many alternatives.
It was, yeah. So really, I think we've got, you know, there's probably 3 or 4 other ideas in the back pocket that we're sort of exploring around the fringes. But that one felt like, particularly in the world of B2B, there wasn't really a strong competitor. There's obviously a lot of bamboo brands that are out in the world with toilet roll, but the costs are quite prohibitive for the B2B market. So so our product is UK made and 100% recycled paper. So it's entirely circular, you know, paper taken from offices and then turned into toilet roll rather than shipped 20,000 kilometers from China. So the local side, the circular side, was a key part. And I think the sort of bigger thing around it is consumer spend is the the biggest lever in any economy. So yeah. I think it's sort of 60 to between 60 and 70% of every economy is consumer spend. That's trillions of dollars in the US. It's big, big money over here. And if that just, you don't need to get all of it to move, but if you get 1, 2, 3% to move to a different brand, these big companies need to start taking notice.
Yeah.
And then that you almost become a catalyst for change there. So
yeah.
One of the things I think is really interesting in toilet paper as an example over here is obviously brands like Cheeky Panda, who gives a crap, have done an amazing job in pushing that sustainable agenda. I think now toilet roll bought online is north of 4 to 5% of the market. So it's that's a big chunk of, excuse me, just that.
It's okay.
Of a frog in the throat. But yeah, so that's a big old chunk of the market. And that's millions and millions of pounds. So if you're Andrex and Cashel, you're thinking, God, what are we going to do? So
yeah.
One of the reactions to that was Cashel have brought out a double length roll without a core. So much smaller, more product. So it cuts down on carbon emissions. So it becomes a sustainable alternative. They're all looking at wrapping in paper rather than plastic. They wouldn't be doing that if brands like us weren't pushing them along. And I think that sort of act of these brands as a catalyst, you know, on a much, much bigger scale, there's no way the world would have moved as quickly as it has to get rid of the internal combustion engine if Tesla wasn't there.
Yeah.
Tesla is this agitator. It's it's one of the most valuable companies in the world. Whatever you say about the founder, the job Tesla have done to like be this catalyst and drive change has been incredible, and it wouldn't have happened as quickly without this sort of change brand from outside coming and shaking things up.
Yeah.
So with innovations around things as you've just described, you know, recycled toilet paper, I know there's bamboo tissue paper, and I listened to quite a long debate on, I think it was Radio 4, about bamboo versus recycled toilet paper, which was really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. Are we realistically moving towards the big brand leaders coming away from non-sustainable toilet roll? Because in reality, it shouldn't actually exist now, should it? But it does. So can you see them actually shifting away, taking away those unsustainable choices and moving their business models into only sustainable choices?
I mean, I'd love to see that happen. I think maybe in 10 years, that might be the world we're in, where a toilet roll made from trees that we need for many other reasons than to wipe our bum is a very real possibility. I think at the moment there are challenges with, you know, recycled, for instance, is more expensive than virgin pulp at the moment, which is pulp made from freshly cut down trees, because there isn't as much paper in the office environment as there was. So, you know, there's still a role in terms of, no pun intended, but there's still a role for that. I think bamboo is a good alternative, but again, there's challenges with it being needing to be cultivated in mainland China. So it's, however, you know, there's companies that talk about making it in Europe, but the source material was grown in China and then shipped. Wherever it is shipped here in Europe, it comes into Europe and then it is converted. Mm. So you can say made in Europe, but it's from China. There are other things in exploration. So there's a brilliant product that we're looking into, which is from recycled Tetra Paks, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
There's things from when there's so many, you know, Tetra Paks in circulation. Yeah. There's they're looking at sugarcane and other things, and actually using straw to turn into material. So I mean, straw doesn't feel like it would give a particularly comfortable wipe, but you know, they can.
But neither does bamboo.
Neither does bamboo. Yeah, exactly. No. So I think whether the answer is recycled, whether the answer is bamboo, I think there is definite
alternatives,
momentum behind the shift now, and that wasn't there 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And there's obviously going to be cost pressures, the cost of living crisis and all the pressure we've got on that to keep costs down. But I think, but love to be sitting here in 10 years time and think we played a part in the world moving away from toilet roll made of trees. That'd be incredibly.
I also think from a kind of consumer consciousness and also consumer awareness piece, there are more people, I mean, me being one of them, that is more likely to push back at a big brand now that is saying that their packaging in plastic is 100% recyclable, which if you get in your car and drive 40 miles to a specific recycling unit, yes, it may be, but it's not curbside. It's not even in the local supermarket. You know, it's prohibitive for really to be recycled because we just don't have the infrastructures. But of course, I'm also now able to go back and question and say, well, how come these guys are doing it with paper? How come, you know, why aren't you doing that? And it's that the kind of consumer pressure that is also now being, because of these other brands existing and because of this new awareness, you're able to question brands as to, well, why aren't you doing that? Why are you still using plastic? Why aren't you using paper? Which, whilst that's not going to be the deciding factor of why they change, it's pressure coming from different angles, isn't it? From competitors, from consumer, no doubt from shareholders at some point saying, is this a climate risk? And it's, again, it's just that those stakeholders coming together to put that pressure on brands to be doing things differently.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so one of the things I look at quite a lot in the book, without going to drop that into it.
Yeah, let's talk about the book. Yeah.
So it's easy to sit outside big brands and throw stones, right? And go, why aren't these big businesses moving faster? Obviously, one of the big benefits the business model is built on scale.
Yes.
So if you're a small brand, you can come in and you can manufacture something in, you know, single trucks and small volumes, and you can make a change and you can offer a better solution to the client, to the end user and the audience. If you're a massive company like Unilever or a Coke or a PepsiCo or whoever it might be, your business is built on scale. So doing that at the scale it needs to be done at is really hard, and it adds, you know, billions in cost. And will it ultimately make a difference to the end user, and will it be a commercial benefit in the long run is sort of the conversation they're having internally.
Yeah.
I think one of the things with researching the book, I've spoken to lots of different change brand, like founders of brands who are changing this up. But I've also spoken to someone I'm going to call Agent Change, who's effectively a secret barrister style figure within a big corporate, and has, you know, to get that perspective of why they're not moving faster.
Okay.
And I think that, which I think has been really important in terms of providing a balanced argument, right? It's very easy to sit outside and shoot arrows and throw stones at big companies for not moving fast enough, but the balance is important. I think one thing that I think's really came out is that these big companies are marketing driven. They call them, you know, the consumer is at the heart of our company. We're customer led.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which I believe from having worked firsthand with a lot of these companies, they want their insight. They spend thousands and thousands on research every year. If the consumer wants something different, they will act. They will change. So if you start seeing money shifting from Andrex to Serious Tissues or Cheeky Panda, That's a positive shift forward, right?
Yeah.
And they will be forced to react to not lose share, to not have their bonuses eaten away or have their CEO asking particular questions about a brand. That I think is where the power is. If you can move what consumers are doing and how they're spending their money, these guys are going to have to change. I think the flip side is they can do pilots, and they've done a lot of pilots Unilever, for instance, did their compressed deodorant a few years ago, which was a really interesting product on the shelf. Obviously, looked a lot smaller, so the consumer thought, there's no value in this. It's not as high value as the massive bottle of Sure. So it failed because there wasn't the education piece beside it. And the technology actually was probably pretty genius and would have been a good thing for them to get out there. The dangerous thing is if you go, oh, we did a pilot and it failed.
Yeah.
You then have the license internally to go, oh, well, the consumer didn't want it.
Yeah.
And I think that's dangerous because you can go, oh, we're consumer led, but no one actually wanted this trial. But if you don't support it, and they've had something similar with the refillable cleaning products recently where they've trialed them and with no support, and the change hasn't happened and it's seen as a failure internally. And it's a really odd one, because they want to be seen to be making positive movements, but then also if it fails, then they can just keep on doing what they're doing and maximizing profit lines and all that. So it's a weird, I think there's cognitive dissonance on a corporate wide level in these companies. They want to make positive changes, but they also want to keep, you know, doing what they've been doing and making millions.
Yeah. And I guess that point that you said about behavior change, it's difficult. Okay. It's a challenge. It's interesting. We, on the podcast, it's not live yet, but there's a podcast we did with Sandy Skies out of Porto Novelli, and she was talking about this is the first time in their research over a 20-year index that they've been measuring that actually consumers now are talking about behavior change. They're willing to make changes to their behavior in the products that they choose, the way they travel, how they eat, how they behave. So it's not about action intention of what they're spending and their spending power. This is actually, she said, bigger than that. We're seeing these intentions in a way that we've never seen it tracked before. So there is clearly more awareness, clearly more appetite from people to get involved and start driving those shifts. And the same point we kind of had with Sandy was around which is great, you know, people power is a real thing, and collectively the more that is scaled and the more change that it brings about, the more that organizations have to think, how do we react to that and do things, and maybe not just pilot things and then didn't work, stop, but kind of how do we pilot that and optimize it, and how do we learn about it, and how do we keep going with it, and how do we educate people at the same time? And you know, it's a program of education. It takes time. It's not a kind of one and done, and one hit wonders in marketing rarely work. You know, I mean, that's kind of 101. So there is this, but then there's also this element of who should be driving responsible behavior. Is it that consumers should be driving that? Or surely organizations should also be thinking, we need to be innovating to keep pace with the changes that are happening with the consumers that are inevitable and that we're already starting to see. So there's a kind of sit and rest on your laurels, but at the same time, be innovating alongside and educating. I'm not saying it's easy, but definitely organizations, I don't think they should just be sitting there saying, well, the market doesn't want it, so we're not going to do it.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think, a lot to unpack in there, but I think a couple of points. I think, firstly, little changes can open the door to bigger ones. So, you know, the thought of changing your loo roll might lead you to fly less, or think about how much meat you're eating, right? So like little things that you start to introduce open the door to bigger things, which I think we're seeing, because it's really hard to get someone to change the car they drive or never fly, and you wouldn't expect to, but little things add up and they start to open the door to bigger lifestyle changes. I think secondly, to your point about these big FMCG companies and how quickly they change, I think it all comes down to the frame they're looking at it through. So I think there's a little bit of a case of loss aversion on a corporation-wide scale. So you're going, we have X million or billion in revenue from this product. If we move away from that, that might cost us money. So if you look at something like refillable cleaning products, currently, so they are tablets rather than, so 90% of what's in a cleaning bottle you'd buy is water. Mm-hmm. It's mad that we're spending money and time and carbon to ship water around the world.
Yeah.
When everyone, not everyone in every country, but particularly in a lot of Europe, and you know, water is readily available. So having tablets, which are, you could fit 20 in a pack the size of a single bottle.
Exactly.
And you then refill that. It's cheaper for the customer, cheaper for the producer. It's basically, and it's way better for the planet to move to that. But the act of changing, if you're a Clorox or a Reckitt's or Unilever or P&G who've got massive share of this market, and suddenly you're selling something that is a little bit cheaper, takes up less shelf space, changes the buying habits of an individual because maybe they're in the market less often. It's seen as a risk. It's seen as the chance to lose a lot of money. And you might actually shrink the size of that category, which is something that, in terms of from a value point of view, which is something they don't want because they've got big chunks of it, 20, 30, 40% of it each, or whatever the breakdown is. The retailer doesn't want the value of that category going down. So there's this, I mean, I think it could well happen with cleaning products where there's a bit of a Kodak moment where all these companies have invented the technology, they've bought brands that have the technology and not really pushed them. It will get to a point where the world moves because it is better for everybody to move, but it's seen as a threat. So when you're managing a loss, you're acting defensively, you're closing down. Whereas if you look at it through the view of opportunity, if I'm Unilever and I'm going, well, actually, if we start doing these products, I don't know, direct to consumer, for instance, and obviously they won't because they're massive relationships with retailers, but they could go from having a 10% share of that sector to 100% share of one person's spend on cleaning products from a year. Suddenly that's a big opportunity. Mm. You're not paying the retailer's margin by doing it direct. So you're taking more for yourself as the business. So if you view it as opportunity and gain and, you know, a way to move forward and build competitive advantage rather than a threat and a loss to be managed, it changes the game dramatically. So framing things as a opportunity rather than a threat, I think is interesting. And I also think maybe those two things don't go hand in hand within a big company. So you might have, you know, business as usual is doing what it needs to do and manage the relationship and the brand they've already got and the market share they've already got. P&G are doing something really interesting. They've got a brand called EC30, which is effectively a cleaning product that is water-free and you dissolve it in water. But when you go on the site, there's no mention of P&G. It's all very subtle. It's branded like a D2C business. It feels like something they've created in a separate part of P&G, away from the main body. And they're almost trialing it, disrupting themselves. If you can disrupt yourself from within, you can grasp that opportunity. Rather than having someone else coming along and eating your lunch, eat your own lunch and move it to a different brand and follow that behavior. So that for me felt like a bit of a, oh, that's a way it can work, because you've got all the resources and expertise and NPD ability of massive companies with deep, deep pockets. And then you can disrupt other companies. You can use it as a way to get new customers into your business. So there is, I just think the mindset needs to shift from being one of loss, this framing of loss aversion, through to grasping opportunity. And that, and you can have both in the organization at the same time, but having the ability to grasp opportunity, I think is where it's exciting.
I like that idea of disruption from within, but I guess from a lot of what, taking everything you've said there, you know, how Unilever bring out the deodorant, the compressed deodorant, they don't put any support and money behind it, and marketing and education and why they've done it and really drive it like they do their other products. Is there something around the metrics that they're still trying to measure new innovation with the same metrics as their current product range? So, you know, if they're not willing to put the marketing budget behind it and they're not willing to look at measuring the efficiencies and the cost savings and seeing that as a massive opportunity as opposed to just sales and growth, and then they'll pull it and say, well, the consumer didn't want it. They're kind of not really, they're not trying as hard as they actually could be. I understand where you said, you know, they might start to lose market share, but if they're, again, the metric is market share, as opposed to looking at the long-term vision and what's the long-term share they can gain from it. There's something in the metrics there, isn't it? That the old model, the old business model is hindering taking that new innovation and actually plowing your marketing money into that.
Yeah, 100%. I think, like, couldn't agree more. I think the interesting thing around the scale of these companies is if you are a new brand and you do 2-3 million quid in the first year, you're doing amazingly, absolutely amazingly, and ripping up all sorts of trees and doing amazing things, right? If you're doing that inside a massive company, a couple of million quid doesn't really move the dial when you're when you're talking about billion-dollar turnovers and huge amounts of money coming in every day. So that's the, if it's judged purely on that metric, it's set up to fail and not be a priority within the business.
Yeah.
Setting it up as a separate entity, the sort of innovator's dilemma from that book around disrupting from within but as a separate entity feels really interesting, because you can incentivize this group over here to, you know, to disrupt and win share. And that might mean winning share from yourself, but it might also mean winning share from competitors, being in a category you weren't in before, all sorts of opportunity in that regard. So like, it feels like, and then judging it on those metrics suddenly feels, it might be a new market. It might, you know, judging on those metrics feels like it makes sense. And then 10 years down the line, that brand could become one of the power brands within a big company. Yeah. But it takes time to get to that point.
Yeah. And it's like having your own incubators, isn't it? Inside your own kind of startup incubators, but we're funding it, we're researching it, we're seeing how it goes. We're going to give it the, we're going to invest in it, you know, and we're going to see where this goes. So, I mean, that most certainly makes sense. And the one of the questions I want to talk about, Chris, is that aspect about the organizations that are doing this. You have written a book. I think it's nearly finished, or it's finished now. Is it
almost.
Nearly almost? And in that, this is, from my understanding, an exploration about this social impact aspect of the businesses and what they're doing, and the way, because one of the things we like to share with our marketers is the practicalities of how social impact organizations are doing this successfully. They're creating the win-win-win along the way for their own business, for the consumer, for the planet. It's profitable, and it's also future-proofing, because everything evolves, right? Everything evolves. I know we've kind of, many businesses have, but they all have R&D. They're all kind of, what's the next thing that we need to be doing? And of course, as things are evolving with regards to those metrics, like, you know, Gemma and you were just talking about there around metrics maybe need to change and we need a different lens. Surely those metrics need to also be considering some of these other aspects around planetary concerns and community and impact to communities and some of those other aspects where there is discontent. You know, there's lots of challenge now coming up for businesses in the landscape that they operate in that wasn't there before. So there has to be more accountability and responsibility around pollution and chemical use and, you know, and indeed resource and procurement and all of those elements. So not just about carbon, but also about, as we've been talking in the past few weeks on the podcast, around biodiversity loss and various things. So there's a lot more for businesses to be considering. It kind of isn't business as usual when the landscape is changing so rapidly. So talk to us a little bit about navigating that challenge.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big, big question. So a couple of things. I think you're seeing things like impact becoming more fundamental in every organization. So there's a court case at the moment in the States where PepsiCo are being sued because their products are 45% of the rubbish in the river in upstate New York.
And being sued for billions. You know, these aren't minor sums. This is billions.
Yeah, and it's the Buffalo River, I think. And the interesting thing is when you look at carbon emissions, you don't know where the carbon's come from. Or it's pretty hard to track. When you look at pollution, ocean pollution, they basically went back and tracked it and were like, okay, this is a Mountain Dew, a Pepsi, a Fritos, a Doritos bag, and they went, 45% is this business, so let's take them on. So that is hugely accountable. And I think you're seeing more and more legal cases of similar sorts all around the world that are going to be pushing these companies forward. And if it costs them money, they need to act. Because I think if you just... I think money is the most powerful human invention of all time, right? It makes the world go round. It builds cities. It acts as a time machine. It drives things forwards. All the conversation around degrowth and and things like that, and getting people to do things if it's not going to make them money is really fucking hard, right? Without meaning to, you know, go too far, but it's, you know, it's the way the world has been set up for thousands of years.
Rightly or wrongly,
it is
the way it is.
It is powerful. Yeah. So if you can, basically by aligning the two things together rather than making them oppositional, so this is a way to make more money by entering this market, rather than this is a way to manage loss, or suddenly it just changes the mindset hugely. And I think the other thing that's interesting is, so the rise of impact investing, which we're seeing across the world, billions and billions going into companies that are making positive things happen. Again, that and it becoming increasingly untenable to have fossil fuel stocks, no matter how ridiculous the dividend is and all of that kind of thing. So, you know, moving the money to back companies that are winning. And I think, but if those companies need to be winning and making good money and winning share, and then the money will follow them. So it's not like the money is going to back companies that aren't going to win.
No.
Companies need to be, that's one of the things in the book, brands that are making positive change. I argue that it's a competitive advantage, right? Sustainability is not, it's moved way beyond table stakes and a hygiene factor. It's a competitive advantage for a lot of companies. If you've got a good story and you're doing something differently, people want it increasingly. Clearly there's a question about affordability in at the moment in particular.
Yep.
But as brands get bigger, their scale means they can be more affordable.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yep.
So you need the people who have the money to be able to back these companies to grow. So I think there's something a bit like the innovation adoption curve, where you've got the early adopters coming on board, and then there's this almost this chasm before it goes mainstream. If you've got companies riding that wave, getting backed by people who place sustainability at the heart, then they reach a scale where they can compete. And then suddenly, if they're the same price as Andrex, it becomes, and the product's equitable quality and all of those kind of things, it becomes a no-brainer for people to switch.
Yeah.
But you need those companies to be getting to a certain scale. Keep coming back to it, but move the money, change the world.
Yeah. Because those products have to be accessible. You know, if you're going into your regular store, they've got to be there.
But also, they've got to stop putting unrealistic premiums on sustainable options. You know, there was some work done that showed anything up to 300% premiums on beauty products that are more sustainable. You know, that's a choice. That's a considered choice by that organization to do that. That's, you know, not something that necessarily they're doing because their costs have gone up that much. So I think there is a balance there in terms of that behavior. But generally, what have been some of the biggest challenges you've had to overcome to retain your position and integrity on sustainability?
So, I mean, plastic in toilet roll has been really tough. So these are massive machines that operate at ridiculous speed, and slowing them down by getting it wrapped in paper or put in boxes adds complexity and adds cost. So there's been many times where people have said, oh, put in this slightly different type of plastic or whatever it might be. And we've always stuck to our guns on that because it's a bit of a non-negotiable. I think we've had things like, so over the last couple of years, tree planting has become a lot more expensive. So what worked really well with the model initially suddenly became untenable. So we've had to look at how our model works, and we've announced some changes to that recently that we think makes it stronger. Gives it a bit more tangibility to the individual. So that was something that was interesting. I think, I mean, more recently, all the developments around carbon neutral and how you can talk about that, I think is something that has changed how we talk about ourselves, and that's led into the impact. So I think a lot of it is, you know, keeping that core of what you're trying to do at the heart, and making, yeah, there'll be certain things that are red lines that you can't move on. There'll be certain things that there may be a better way to do it and to talk about it. Everything we've ever made is made in the UK. Apart from our laundry ships, they're made in Sweden. and that's a non-negotiable. It's all locally, as locally as possible.
As local as possible.
Yeah, so we've had conversations about, you know, buying in parent roll, which is the source material from Indonesia or Middle East or China, making stuff in China. It's a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
Even when you ship it, it's a lot cheaper. It gives you a commercial advantage to do that. But we had question marks over the supply chain over there and obviously the fact of it being shipped miles and miles and miles and the emissions that come with that. So, you know, it's so the companies that we compete with that do ship things from China offset their emissions from shipping. But claiming you're carbon neutral through offsetting is no longer something you can do.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. And look, big company, what we don't want, I think the thing that one of my pet hates is this idea of virtue shaming.
So, yeah.
And it happens a lot with big companies. So, you know, someone massive will do something positive and they will bring about it might be a packaging innovation or something like that. At the scale they're operating at, that makes a massive difference. But suddenly, and probably more than a lot of small brands would, right? Because it's billions of units. And then what happens is they announce something. And I totally believe and agree they should be moving faster. But something happens, they announce something positive, and then everyone's like, what about this? What about this? What about this? What about this? And it just creates the conditions where companies are like, well, should we bother? Does it just invite more negativity towards the company rather than positivity? It should be like, it's hard, but it should be applauded. And then it should be like, okay, what's next? And it should be received in a positive way, in the way it's intended. Because if you do change, I don't know, regenerative farming, or employing women in farms that prioritize women in different parts of the world, the difference that makes is enormous.
Yeah.
But it's just blown over because it's like, oh, we still
wrapping things in plastic.
You still do this here.
Yeah,
you still do this here. Yeah. And like, I think that doesn't create the conditions for companies to move quickly.
Yeah.
It creates conditions for companies to manage the loss and do it negatively.
And kind of close up.
It's not always benefits to the consumer, is it? You know, that's the thing. It's like, what's the benefit to the consumer? It doesn't have, you know, actually there's supply chain, as you say, there's people, there's workers, there's, you know, what it does in terms of their land and food security and water supply. And that's where the big education piece comes in, isn't it? Around explaining why you've done something. It doesn't necessarily have to pass down to the people that have a relatively the privilege of purchasing a product.
But that's where this challenge comes with communication, you know, getting into the marketing and the communication side of things. This is where that art and skill is around what do we say, what don't we say, how do we say it to different stakeholders, and how do we bring our audiences along with us in that transparent way? So, yes, we've made this change and it's enormous. Don't attack us because this is the plan and this is what's coming next, you know, and we know it's not perfect. And I think that there aren't many organizations. I mean, it seems to be increasingly that maybe on the comm side of things, this is starting to shift a bit. But that having the courage to be that transparent, to talk about how you're doing things, to talk about, you know, I mean, it, again, we had a couple of guests on from different organizations, Gavin from Pinwheel and Dr. Sam Sinclair from Biodiversify. And Sam was talking about, oh, I've got these clients that are doing amazing things in biodiversity, but we can't even talk about them because it's all under, you know, NDAs and you can't talk about what they're doing. And Gavin said, that kind of breaks my heart that we can't talk about what they're doing because we need to be talking about what people are doing so that it raises the bar for everybody else and we can all learn together and we can all see that, okay, that's where they are so far. And so there is this communication challenge, isn't there, Chris? Do you pick up on this in the book?
A little bit, yeah. I think, the main focus is on the brands that are what I call change brands. So brands that, you know, take a lot of the similar sorts of mindsets of challenger brands, but they're setting out to solve one of the biggest problems facing society and humanity. So they're shaking things up. They're doing things. They're trying to establish moral leadership in a category. So, you know, there's a lot of talk about obviously category leadership or brand leadership, but this idea of taking the more high ground and being able to claim that, I think is an important one. So the book really focuses on those sorts of brands. So it's called Obsolete.
Uh-huh.
And that idea comes from a quote by an amazing guy called Buckminster Fuller, which is basically, you don't change things by fighting the existing model. You change things by creating a new model that makes the old one obsolete.
Yeah.
So the idea is that these brands that are doing all they can to minimize their footprint on the planet with their product and doing all they can to maximize their forward impact are the future.
Yeah.
And while they're unlikely to go out and make, I don't know, Nestle or Mars obsolete, and they might knock a couple of brands, they might change that behavior. They might get them to move a bit quicker
if
they realize that, you know, one of the great brands I speak to is Grub Club.
Came on the podcast.
Amazing. Got this brilliant story with a crazy stat that if dogs and cats were a country, they'd be the fifth biggest consumers of meat in the world, right? And by shifting to protein from insects, the benefits are huge and
enormous.
That's definitely something that surely is on the radar of massive companies that are in this space. Like similarly, the fact most chewing gum has got plastic. As much plastic in it as a plastic straw. Staggering, right? So, and consumers don't really know that gum base, which is on the back of the packet, is actually plastic. Chewing like PVA. So those kind of things are staggering, and those kind of things are getting out there, and they will get these brands to move. But it's taking a little while, I think.
Yeah.
But it's you know, as share grows, as they see consumers wanting different things, as legislation, I think interestingly, if Serious Tissue can show that you can do things in this way, or you know, bottled like water can be served in cans rather than plastic bottles, so it makes it easier for legislators to then go, actually, do we really need plastic bottles for water?
Mm.
You could legislate against things like, do you really need plastic bottles for fizzy drinks? Like, arguably not. So if you can prove that it's working. So like with Tesla again, they proved that it would work at scale. Therefore, legislators had the confidence to then go, okay, the phase out of the combustion engine is going to start. And after 2030, this is the rules. So you give confidence to legislators, which makes brands move faster. So you create this sort of beautiful ripple effect in the world that feels like it starts from something really tiny, like a brand and maybe, you know, 20,000 people changing their behavior. But the knock-on effect from that, it can be staggering.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I love that quote by David Attenborough in his COP26 address when he says what we need is millions of different small innovators now changing the world. And that's kind of what these social impact brands are doing. You know, they've got their heart on their sleeve. They dig their heels in when it comes to the values that they're not prepared to compromise on, and they are changing the world, you know, one innovation at a time. And so I can't wait to read more about that, Chris. So when is the book out?
It's out in October.
In
the final stages of edit and adding a few more conversations with different brands and different great founders. So speaking to the guys from Tony's Chocolate Only and Oatly and all sorts. So it's been brilliant. I think it was really important not just to be the ramblings of one person who's worked on a couple of brands, right? It needed to be a kind of collective viewpoint from all these different brands that are pushing. So, you know, the likes of Matt from Fussy, the guys from Grub Club, I mentioned Oatly and Tony's Chocolate Only. He's talking to Nick from Small, Douglas from Tony's. So there's lots of very, you know, people and businesses at different scales. So tiny businesses through to someone like Oatly, who are obviously a massive, massive global player, and pretty much they're a unicorn, aren't they, at the moment?
Brilliant. Okay. Well, look, we could go on, and we'd love to have you back on the podcast when the book's out as well, Chris, talking about some of those cases and some of the insights from there. So I really look forward to that. So we like to ask all of our guests the three same questions to wrap up each of our podcasts. So the first question coming at you, Chris, is, Can marketing save the planet? What's your view?
So I think I've got a slightly nuanced view of this. So I used to think when I was in agency land that the brands and the campaigns you put out into the world can definitely make a positive impact. I think my belief would be that brands can change the world.
Uh-huh.
Marketing maybe cannot, because I suppose it's marketing behind the right brands. So if you've got the brands that are growing, the brands that are seen as success stories and winning market share and getting investment and having brilliant advertising behind them, use those amazing tools that we've all learned and put them behind the right brands. The other thing that's fascinating from going through this process is the amount of brands that we've been talking about that have come from people who've worked in marketing roles or advertising roles. It's not just us with Serious Tissues and Change Please. It's Matt from Fussy was a creative, and yeah, the guys from Liquid Death were creatives. Like, having those ideas, it's not actually from within this world coming up with an idea for a brand. From outside, it looks really hard, but you know, this is our core competency. Creating a brand that has a brilliant position and unique, distinctive place, the right brand.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there are millions of brands sat in bottom drawers all over London and New York and all sorts of things that could turn into something. Liquid Death started off as a random scamp idea for an ad that he shot a film for, and now it's a 700 million pound company in terms of valuation. So
yeah,
I'd say if you're sitting there listening to it in an agency, have you got an idea for a brand that that could change things? Because the other stuff you can learn. Sometimes it's hard looking at spreadsheets and all of that kind of thing, but you can learn that. The magic that we've all got is the bit that gives you the ability to create those brands that can change the world.
Yeah. And that all starts with the problem though, doesn't it? And it's kind of, what problem am I looking to solve? And then how do I develop the kind of value proposition around that problem? So creative is important, but if you're not really hitting a kind of hearts and mind problem, that makes it more challenging, surely.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. I think you need to be solving a problem people care about.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think you're ideally looking at, I think there's a formula which I talk about in one of the chapters in the book around a category problem combined with an issue, a positive impact on an issue people care about.
Exactly.
And if you can do those two things together, you've got the recipe for a brilliant change brand.
Yeah.
And our second question, Chris, is what do you hope business looks like in 10 years' time?
So I think we talked about it with Serious Tissues. I think pushing the market collectively to be in a better place and move beyond toilet roll made from trees and all of that. I think there are enough brands that are pushing and creating pressure on that. I want to see more and more brands, more and more of these change brands that are coming out, starting small, pushing positive shifts in society, in markets, shaking up the status quo, winning share from other brands. I think we've got other ideas that we're working on that could come to fruition relatively soon. It's all about timing, and it's hard. It's hard to do a lot of this, and there's probably never been a harder time to launch a business than post-COVID, during a massive recession with all sorts of energy price nightmares. It's hard, but it's massively rewarding, and the difference it can make is huge. So more brands that are pushing and change brands replacing status quo brands would be the thing I'd love to see in 10 years. Yeah. A lot of the brands that are already getting traction, being at
major players
levels, being major players, and more kind of following on the coattails of these trailblazers.
Yeah. Brilliant. And the last question then, Chris, what is the one piece of advice you would give to a marketer grappling with this whole social impact change brand dilemma?
So I think, you know, it's hard when you... you are sat within an agency, for instance, or within a big company, and you're working on a particular brand or a particular brief, and there's only certain ways you can take it without embarking into greenwashing. rolling a turd in green glitter to try and make it look slightly more sustainable. I think trying to find a way to create the briefs you want to work on, and giving them opportunities to go forward. So, you know, for instance, like Change Please, when it started, was an idea from within the agency. That in a beautiful moment of serendipity, I was living in Peckham, and Jamal was starting something similar with homeless people as well. So it was this beautiful moment of serendipity that created something great. It was very much a side hustle for a long time and has become something huge. I think there's ways you can balance it. So, while in the early days of Serious Tissues, I was still consulting into big companies to pay the mortgage, feed the kids, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So you don't need to be all in from day one on things like this. You can build slowly. You know, there's like any project, there's moments when it's heavy and you're developing the brand and the website and stuff like that. Moments when it's tough. And then there's moments when it can sort of take care of itself, and the rhythm of the business is different. So I suppose try and create the briefs you want to work on. If you're within a big company, that sense of disrupting from within, carving out opportunities, you know, you might be sitting there at Unilever going, I think if we did this, we could win this much share from P&G by launching it in this way. So almost frame it in the language of business. Don't try and frame it as like, this is, I think if it, while we know it's the right thing to do, trying to implore someone to do something because of some sort of, you know, moral imperative is hard. And it's easy for people to go, well, you know, I want to do it, but there's all these business reasons not to. So if you can frame it in the language of business, and show that by doing this, there is a real reason to do this in terms of commerciality, which is the language a lot of these big companies speak, you'll get traction. If you're just doing it as the right thing to do, the minute the business is put under pressure and there's shareholder conversations and they're getting slated in the FT, it'll get canned. So just
build the business case.
Speak in the language of business. So you know, it could be a case of capturing 100,000 more email addresses that you can use to feed your marketing machine. That's suddenly a commercial case for doing something.
Yeah.
Thinking the commercial rather than the, it'll make your life easier if you think in that way.
Exactly.
Obviously you need to think in the other way first, but if you need to sell it internally, speak in the language that the business respects and wants, would be the gist of it, really.
Fantastic. Brilliant. Well, great advice. Great advice indeed. Well, what a fabulous set of insights that we've had from you, Chris. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. We really look forward to finding out more about the book. Where can people find out more about what you're up to, what Serious Tissues are up to?
Thanks so much for having me. I think the book site will be up live pretty soon. I don't think it's quite ready yet in terms of that side. LinkedIn, seriousissues.com, all of those kind of things. And look, if anyone's got an idea for a brilliant change brand, very happy to have a chat and see if we can make it a reality.
Fantastic.
It's been interesting. It's been a long couple of months of sitting in a dark room writing a book, so it's nice to speak to some people.
Yes. Oh, it's great to have you here. And of course, we'll make sure that all those links are available on the show notes. And when your book site does go live, just send us the link and we'll make sure we drop that in, even if the podcast goes live. So stay tuned and we'll keep you updated. So thank you again for being on the podcast and look forward to speaking soon.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for tuning in to the CAM Marketing Save the Planet podcast. We hope that you're enjoying these conversations just as much as we are. And if you are enjoying them, then please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast channel and indeed to share the podcast with your colleagues, your friends, your family, because the more people we can get engaged in these conversations, the better. You'll find the podcast on all the usual podcast platforms, and you'll also find it on the Marketing Society podcast and the Global Player. For more information about the podcast and indeed the work we do, please visit www.canmarketingsavetheplanet.com. There you will find information about our latest books. You'll find information about our online sustainable marketing training hub and the training and advisory services that we offer. And you'll also find our Learning Zone, which is an absolute resource hub filled with all things sustainable marketing. So we look forward to hearing more from you, and we look forward to catching up soon.